Okay, this is another in our series of songs, singing the Lord's song. We've called it two-part harmony, but really the sub-theme is, can we be intimate in a changing world? And I'm Marge Wohl, Director for Ministry and Changing Communities for the American Lutheran Church.
And I'm Erling Wohl, a pastor, Garden Grove, Orange County, in Southern California.
Okay. Well, we agree, or we think, that everybody in this world would like to have intimacy with at least one other person, to feel that in your lifetime you have communicated and gotten to know one other person quite well. Now, maybe it's one of the delusions of our time that that intimacy can be achieved with a marriage partner. And we're certainly finding that a lot of people later on come for counseling because they can't talk to each other. And we just read something the other day by some quote-unquote expert who said that our generation may be the last generation to reach 25 years of marriage, that 25th anniversaries will become very uncommon because most people will not stay married that long. Well, of course, ours may be the first generation where a lot of people were reaching 25 and 50 years, because 25th anniversaries have not been very common until about the middle of this century, because the life expectancy of women was much shorter, and most men outlived one or two wives. So, you know, that may be, we may be the first and last generation to have 25th and 50th anniversaries. But the question is, given the fact that we are all living longer, obviously it is getting more and more difficult to maintain intimacy in a relationship over the long haul, because we are not the same people at 35 that we were when we were 20, and certainly not the same people at 55 that we were at 35, or at 70 that we were at 55. And so we're going to be changing. And so our subtitle is, can we maintain intimacy in the times of change? And Erling and I are going to kind of talk about this a little bit tonight, since we have been married 38 years, and sometimes seems longer than that, sometimes seems shorter than that, but we've had to do a lot of changing. And then 9 years ago, when Erling had his broken neck accident, body surfing, we had a change very abruptly, and that was a traumatic period in our life.
I recall when Marge had been married 2 years, somebody asked her how long. She said, seems like an eternity.
So now, 38 years later, or 36. Last week I read a story, and those of you who heard it will have to forgive me for reading it again, but several people asked about it and asked if I would read it again. And it's called A Day in the Life of a Smiling Woman. And it kind of sets a tone, I think, for this whole business of communicating and maintaining intimacy as we change. Because not all change is traumatic and comes out of crisis. Most change comes because we simply develop and grow as human beings. I remember when I was directing day nurseries, often mothers would come up to me at the end of the year and just thank me profusely, because they said, I just can't thank you enough for all that you've done for my child in this year. I can't believe how much he or she has grown and developed. You know, and I didn't want to just come out and say, well, that would have happened whether they were here or anyplace else, because we do grow and develop. And so most changes are developmental. And those are the changes that are toughest, I think. I think people can adjust to the great crises in life, but we have a tough time with the slow changes that erode away at our memories of what the other person was or what we expected they would be. So here's the story, A Day in the Life of a Smiling Woman by Margaret Drabble. And I'm just going to read the first part of it. It's a long story, and I guess you'll have to finish it yourself if you're interested in the conclusion. There was once this woman. She was in her 30s. She was quite famous in a way. She hadn't really meant to be famous. It had just happened to her without very much effort on her part. Sometimes she thought about it a little bewildered and said to herself, "This is me, Jenny Jameson, and everybody knows it. It's me." Her husband was quite famous too, but only to people who knew what he was doing. He was famous in his own world. He was the editor of a weekly, and so he had quite a pull with certain kinds of people. It was through his pull, really, that Jenny had gotten her job. She was getting bored. The little child was at nursery school and the big ones at big school. So he had looked about for her and asked a few friends and found her a nice little job at a television station. But he hadn't quite bargained for how she would catch on. Everybody had always thought Jenny was pretty. In fact, she'd been a very recognizable type for years, had Jenny. Pretty, a little restless, driven into the odd moment of malice by boredom, loving her children, cooking dinners, flirting a little. She deserved a little job. But when she got going, when she got on the screen, she was transformed. She became very quickly beautiful. It took a few weeks while she experimented with hairstyles and clothes and facial expressions. And suddenly she was a beauty, and total strangers talked of her with yearning. And that wasn't all, either. She was also extremely efficient. Now, she always had been efficient. She'd always been able to get all the courses of a four-course meal onto the table, perfectly cooked, at the right moment. She was never late to collect children from school. She never forgot their dinner money or their swimming things, and she never ran out of sugar or lavatory paper or sellotape. So people shouldn't have been surprised at the way she settled down to work. She was never late. She never forgot appointments. She never forgot her briefing. She began quietly interviewing people about cultural events in a spot in an arts program. And she always managed to say the right things to everyone. She never offended and yet never made people dull. She was intelligent and quick. She had sympathy for everyone she talked to. And all the time she looked so splendid, sitting there shining and twinkling. Everyone admired her. Nobody disliked her. In no time at all, she had her own program, and she was able to do whatever she fancied on it. She used to invite the strangest people to be interviewed, and she would chat to them seriously, earnestly, cheerfully. She told everybody that she loved her job, that she was so lucky, that it fitted on so well with the children and her husband, that she didn't have to be out too much. "It's a perfect compromise," she would say, smiling. She didn't take herself very seriously. "It's just an entertainment," she would say. "I've been lucky," she would say. "All I have to do is have the chats I'd love to have at home, and I get paid to do it. Lovely." Now, her husband did not like this state of affairs at all. He became extremely bad-tempered, never came home if he could avoid it, and yet would never commit himself to being out because he did not want, it seemed, to make Jenny's life any easier. It appeared he wanted to make it as difficult as possible. So he would arrive unexpectedly and depart unexpectedly. Sometimes he'd bring his friends home unexpectedly, and sometimes when he promised, he didn't bring them home. He made endless unpleasant remarks and innuendos about Jenny's colleagues in the television world, as though he had forgotten that he had introduced her to them in the first place. He would accuse her of neglecting him and the children. She was not quite sure how this had all happened. It didn't seem to have much to do with her, and yet she supposed it must be her fault. At night when it was dark, she used to think it was her fault, but in the morning she would get up and go on smiling. Then one night she came back from work, and as she usually did on Wednesday evenings, late and tired. She noticed as she parked the car outside the house that the downstairs lights were still on, and she was sorry because she did not feel like talking. She was too tired. She would have quite liked to talk about her program because it had been interesting. She had been talking to a South African band politician about the problems of political education. But her husband never watched the program these days. She found her key, opened the front door. Her head ached. She was upset, she had to admit it, about South Africa. Sometimes she thought she ought to go and do something about these things that upset her. But what? She pushed open the living room door, and there was her husband lying on the couch. He was listening to a record and reading. She smiled. "Hello," she said. He did not answer. She took off her coat and hung it over the back of a chair. She was going to make herself a milk drink, as she usually did, and go straight to bed. But just for the moment, she was too tired to move. She had had a long day, so she stood there resting, thinking of the walk to the kitchen and how comfortable it would be to get into bed. She was just about to ask her husband if he would like a drink too, though he never did. He didn't like milk, and coffee kept him awake, when a strange thing happened. Her husband put down his book, looked up at her with an expression of real hatred, and said, "I suppose you're standing there waiting for me to offer to make you a drink, aren't you?" Now, the truth was that he had hardly ever made her a drink in the evening after work, so she could not possibly have been expecting such a thing. He had done so perhaps 3 times in the last 6 months. The thought of his offering to get up and make her a drink had never crossed her mind, so she answered politely, "No, I was just going to ask you if you would like one." And then an even stranger thing happened, for no sooner were the words out of her mouth than a rage so violent shook her, as though an electric current had been driven through her, that she began to shake and scream. She screamed at him for some time, and he lay there morosely watching her, as though satisfied that he had by accident pressed the right button. Then she calmed down, went and made her drink, and went to bed. But as she lay down, she felt as though she had had some kind of shock treatment, that she had suffered brain damage and that she would never be the same again. Let us not exaggerate. This was not the first time that this kind of thing had nearly happened to her, but this time it had happened. And the difference between its nearly happening and its happening was enormous. She was a different woman. She went to bed a different woman. In the morning, she woke up, as usual, at about 7:30 and thought of the day ahead. Every day she got up regularly and gave the children their breakfast. Various people, including her husband, suggested from time to time that she should engage somebody to help her with these things. But she always said that she preferred to do them herself. She liked to be with the children, and she did not like other people to see her at that hour in the morning. Also, she would say, smiling disbelievingly, "I'm afraid I might get lazy. If I give myself half an excuse, I might get lazy and stay in bed." On this particular morning, it did cross her mind that she might stay in bed all day. "I really do not see the point of carrying on," she thought, as she lay there and remembered what had happened to her the night before. "I can't possibly win," she thought. "Whatever I do, I will lose, that's certain. I might as well stay in bed." But no, she thought, it's more honorable to fight to the death. So she got out of bed, smiling. Do you want to react to the story at all? I think it's kind of obvious that this couple were not on intimate terms. And yet, apparently they had lived together without much incident for a number of years. And I think that's probably true of most of us if things go well and if nothing changes. And if we remain true to the roles that we adopted when we first married.
I suppose the toughest thing that I've seen in counseling hundreds, I presume thousands of people through a long ministry, is the fact that communication is terribly difficult for most marrieds. And it seems that it's most difficult for men. When I was raised in the Dakota small village home, my mother and father didn't converse hardly at all. It didn't strike me strange because they were the only models I had. But as I've thought of it across the years, it struck me that they didn't communicate. They were not visibly very intimate. They had 7 children, but even the last years they weren't sleeping in the same bed. Some of the most horrifying memories of my childhood when I was a little boy was my father getting drunk. And I thought down the years that maybe that was because he didn't sense he was wanted, or didn't sense that he could communicate, or that he was sealed into himself. In one of our rooms, we had a wood or coal stove. And I can recall Christmas Eve, for example, when he came home drunk, tossed coal in, threw kerosene on top of it, and the place could have blown up or burned up. And I could sense he was cursing inside. That was my first model. My dad worked hard. We respected him for that. But I've often thought he never told me how he felt. To describe his feelings was the most difficult thing in his life. So I think he worked to cover up the person that he really was. And therefore, when I grew up, I suppose I had somewhat of the same model. It's been difficult for me, in the deepest sense, to communicate. First year as married, I think I didn't express feelings much. And my model was my father, who worked ambitiously, provided well, and did a marvelous job. We couldn't fault him for that. But I never knew my father's heart, never knew what he thought, what he felt, never really knew intimacy. The only smile of approval, I think, came when I worked like he did. I can recall the smile I got when I unloaded, if you know what that means, 34 tons of coal by hand from a boxcar on the tracks to a loading platform in one day in the heat of the summer. And it's strange, as I think of it, across the years, I mentioned to one of you today a couple I've hit in recently that pretty much epitomize what I'm trying to say. The man's Scandinavian. So was my father. Wife came in to see me. There's one in every crowd. Wife came in to see me, 22 years married, 2 children. She was quite uptight. So after talking to her, I got him in. He just sat there. Obtuse, you know. Kind of glacial. He worked a full job, provided well, but he worked a second job. He trained pilots of small planes. Didn't make any money at it, but he did it. He expected her to work her 8-hour shift, do the lawn, the housework. Sometimes at 10, he brought his co-pilots in for lunch. She was to make it, clean up, get back to work the next morning. So we talked very intimately and very personally with the two of them, and I thought he saw something of the light. But it wasn't long ago that she came back. One Saturday morning, about 9. I was busy till 2. She was already in the fetal position. She was very serious about taking her life. The months since I talked with him hadn't done any good at all. And so I called him in again. We had a long session. They stuck together for another year. Pardon me, this was back a year ago. And then she came in. And she was all frozen. She was totally through with her relationship with him. Because he hadn't listened to her at all. He hadn't heard her cry. She wanted to talk to him. She wanted to share him. She wanted to know what he felt. And now the man took over the housework, made her into a little wallflower. She couldn't see her mother. She couldn't have friends. He just made her a little flower in the corner, spreading her incense around the home. And he didn't understand that she was screaming inside. I want to talk to you. I want to reach you. I want to know you. And now she's through. Totally broken. And that's one of the difficulties for most of us that are male. We're not told to weep or to express feelings or to say what we feel. Or like that third Norwegian whose wife came running up to him one day and said, "You've told me before I married you that you love me. You haven't told me for 20 years. I know," he said. "I told you when we married that I loved you. If anything ever changed, I'd tell you."
Apparently nobody warned me about marrying Norwegians.
But you didn't expect much of the Poles.
I came from Chicago, Erling from this little town in North Dakota, and had grown up in Chicago. My mother and my father were both born in Chicago. And my father was Polish. My mother was Norwegian, Protestant. My father, Catholic. And it was a big family, just like Erling's. My mother had 11 children. 8 of us grew up. And I was the oldest daughter. I am the oldest daughter. And it was a very freewheeling family. We did a lot of arguing, a lot of talking. It was just the opposite of Erling's, because he remembers dinner times as being very oppressive. They were not allowed to talk at the table, sing at the table, or laugh at the table, or they were punished. And so I used to wonder when we were first married why he ate so fast. You know, he just, the minute we sat down at the table and said grace, his head was down, he got a frown on his between his eyes, and he'd gobble the food. And he'd be through, you know, before I'd even started.
Luckily, I've forgotten all about that.
But finally I said, how come you eat so fast, even when you don't have anything you have to do after dinner? And he talked about then. He said, I guess I've always eaten fast, and that was the reason. They got up and were excused, and then they could go off, and they didn't have to sit there anymore. Whereas around in our family, there were 10 people around the table most of my childhood, and it was very noisy and a lot of arguing, a lot of discussing, a lot of talking over the day's events. And so here I married this quiet or uncommunicative Norwegian who could be extroverted outside the house but at home very quiet. And everybody would say, boy, you must love living with Erling Wold because, you know, he's so full of fun and he tells all those jokes and all. And the minute he walked in the door, he took on, I guess, his father's character and his father's role. And it
was
very...
And he was a character.
Well, anybody named Ole.
That's all bad.
But it was quite frustrating to not have anybody in the house that you could talk with and never argue with. Because if I had anything I even wanted to discuss that implied a difference, Erling would retreat, because in his house you never talked about what they called negative things, so that his older sister gradually became deaf when she was 10 years old, and his mother said, don't ever mention to Adeline that she's deaf. We'll just pretend that she can hear. And so at least Erling developed a great preaching voice all his childhood, yelling, you know, so Adeline could hear. And finally she couldn't hear anything, but he still yelled. But it was that kind of place where you never talked about things. You pretended that nothing was wrong. And in our family, you never pretended. You know, you yelled, screamed, cursed, and whatever it took to get people to listen to you. And arguing was just great, because it never implied that you were no longer friends. It just implied that you were having a good time arguing. So those differences were there. And I think we lived with those differences somewhat painfully through the years, losing ourselves, Erling in his work and me in the children. Because another part of my background was my mother's instruction that a woman's great role in life and all of her fulfillment came from having children. So I did my part by having five, but I never was totally into it the way my mother was, because I had too many other interests in life and couldn't ever quite get caught up in the whole business of seeing things shine. So Erling and I used to, well, we were locked into this whole role business, so that when we were first married and lived in Fort Worth, Texas, where roles are very much part of the order, Texas, a man is a man and a woman is a woman or something. And he and so he always liked to scrub floors, because he had done that at home for his mother, who was a semi-invalid. And I didn't like to scrub floors, because as the oldest girl, I always had to do a lot of housework, and so I had rejected it. But nevertheless, we were both so dominated by this role business that if I were down on the if he were down on the floor scrubbing and somebody came to the door, before we'd let him in, I'd get down on the floor and start scrubbing, and he would pretend that he came out of the study. You know, we just had to live that role. That we both felt very guilty about the fact, but that was part of our life. Now, I think a lot of people, maybe today, begin with the opposite idea. You know, I don't think all young people today have that kind of strict role orientation. But that doesn't mean that sometimes other changes don't take place. Like, we changed from that strict role orientation to great freedom in our roles. But I think nowadays people sometimes change the opposite way. So people who agreed to a free relationship when they got married, then one changes and wants to be in the home and wants to play the role of mother and wants to quit work, and then perhaps the man won't let her quit because the agreement was they would both work and save money and get a home. So a change has come no matter what your role orientation is. And for us, that change came dramatically, suddenly, and without warning.
I suppose in our relationship those first years, I was the number one person. I made my decisions. I traveled a great deal, spoke around the world, and had large parishes, one parish with a staff of 76. So I loved to work from 7 to 11. And it was gorgeous and was very, you know, rewarding, a lot of stroking, all that kind of thing. And my whole structure of thinking, I think, had to do with a man's role was basically his work. Well, the Bible says very clearly, if you can't be a blessing to your family, you're no good to anybody else. But it's strange, I went through about 6.5 years of study beyond college and never heard a paragraph on intimacy, marriage, or relationships. Today, young people are so much more blessed because you have so many more potentials. But this whole business of role, who's number one, it's really a terrifying thing, because what I think comes out in life normally is the fact that each one plays the part of the role that he or she is adequate for. I used to do the income tax. After I broke my neck, my wife had to. She does a much better job than I. The role model changed, much more adequate. She even writes better than I. But my whole concept, I think, of a man measured by two basic things. In society, that's pretty true. One is work, and the other is the fact that you're a virile person, a potent human male. I catch myself often asking people, what do you do? You know, that isn't a very good lead question. She'd ask, who are you? Someone around here asks me, do you know my husband? Do you know my son? It doesn't matter, you see. She should ask, do you know me? I'm important. I'm a human. So that I think that's one of the really tragic things, is we measure people what they do, as if work gives you significance. I was invited a couple of times to the presidential breakfast, once when LBJ was president, and I can still recall the thrill when leaving the Southam Hotel at about 10,000 of us gathered there, he came right by my table. Well, he was just another earthly human being, except he was president, you know. And you kind of glow in the presence. And potency, that one is a potentially sexual person. When I was broken, I was impotent for a long time. And most people measure people as whether they're sort of Joe Namaths, you know. It's amazing how we measure people by their performance, not who they are. One of the greatest men I met in Kansas City. He was born without arms. He's a professor of theology, Union Seminary, New York City. Very brilliant, has a PhD. He does everything with his feet. I watched him at the Hilton, slipped his foot out of his shoe, poured his coffee, buttered his toast. He shaves. He has difficulty only with one thing, and that's to wash his clothes out in hotels, because he travels 6/10 of the time. But he does it. And he says when he gets on the trains in New York City, he has a coin in his shoe, flips the shoe off, tosses the coin in, away he goes. Next to him sat a guy without arms. You know what his business is? He's a CPA. You know what his sport is? Football. Catches it in the foot. It's his hand. So you don't measure people by what they have, who they are. And men have a tough time with that, because it's difficult for them to be personal, intimate, close. And you got to fight to attain it. We're just winging this, see, because she's the one that was asked. I'm just an interlude. I was added. She asked me to share, right?
My interlude.
That's right. My second name is Henry.
Well, anyway, our roles changed. Suddenly, I had to be the breadwinner after all those years of not working for a salary, but just working as a volunteer and being in the home and, you know, kind of, as Erling said, seconding his agenda. And suddenly I was the one whose agenda had to be important, because I had to work, so he had to move with me to Minneapolis. And he had to stay at home, and suddenly I was the one that was coming home at the end of the day, and he'd say, "What happened at the office today?" And I'd say, "Don't ask me about the office, you know, I don't want to talk about it." And then, or he'd tell me about what happened to the vacuum cleaner that day, and it was just total opposite. So it was very bewildering for a while, until we realized that God, you know, gives us gifts for whatever life brings our way. And I discovered I had gifts that I never knew that I had before, and abilities. And Erling also found that he had characteristics and abilities that he never knew he had before. He suddenly found that he had the gift of being able to cry. And we had been married almost 30 years when Erling broke his neck, and I had never seen him shed a tear. Not when our children were ill, not when his father died, not when he buried people who were good friends in the parish. And, you know, it was just seemed unbelievable to me that this person never had feelings that could express themselves in tears. And yet Erling suddenly discovered that he could cry. And we shared an intimacy in tears that we had never shared before. And I wonder how many husbands and wives or lovers or friends ever cry together and realize it's as important to weep together as it is to laugh together, to make love together. And he discovered a sensitivity that he had never had before. He always used to be rather impatient with people who were weak, you know, because he was strong. And weak people shouldn't be that way. Why couldn't they get their act together? And why did people have to be nervous? And why didn't people choose not to be depressed? You know, and it was very difficult to communicate with somebody like that. But there he was suddenly, very, very weak and unable to do a lot of things, and to have to deal with that was very hard for him. We affirm that differences are okay. We are very, very different. Our whole background, you know, rural North Dakota, urban Chicago. And our personalities are different. Erling is what, there's a professor, a psychology professor at Stanford, who's written a whole book about visuals and auditory people. You know, Erling is visual, I'm auditory. That means your whole way of perceiving reality is wired differently. He perceives reality in a visual way. He's related more externally. I'm auditory. Reality comes to me through my own tapes. We find that it's very difficult for Erling to speak without notes, and I do better when I don't have any notes. And so even in preparing for a talk like tonight, he gets very anxious because I can't sit down and write it out word for word. And I get very anxious if he forces me to read from a text. So, you know, we finally affirm that it's okay to be different. We simply have to talk about those differences and affirm that it's okay to be that way, but not to just get locked into kind of round-robin fights that try to change the other person. And most of our fights are over trivia that simply are locked into the fact that I do things one way, he does things another way. So most people who come and can't communicate, first they'll say, well, we always argue about our in-laws, or we always argue about money. But when they come down to the third point, it's usually what we argue about most of the time are dumb little things. Like, she doesn't like that I don't hang my pants up a certain way. Or he doesn't like that I don't write this way in the checkbook. Or the old toothpaste thing, you know, about squeezing it from the top or the bottom. And arguments are like that. And they go, and these are called round robin arguments. So Erling and I mentioned last week in one of our talks that right before he broke his neck, we had spent 3 days not talking to each other. And that was the way we fought. We didn't yell or scream, we just didn't talk. And we didn't even know what it was that we fought about. But I was, well, I knew it was his fault anyway. But, you know, we were locked into that, like, go tell your father that it's time to go swimming now. And he'd say, go tell your mother that I'm not ready. You know?
To jump in the lake.
And so you communicate through the kids. But it's that whole business of just not talking. And you long for intimacy. You long to reach out and touch the other person. Or you long for that person to reach out and touch you. Yet you know if they reached out across that 15-foot wide bed, you'd say, go away, don't touch me, you know, I don't want you to. And so you long for it, and yet you withdraw from it. And it's, you were talking about push-pull, you know, we long for it, we withdraw from it. But what we have learned, so anyway, to finish that story, we were on the beach the day Erling broke his neck, and we still weren't communicating, and a friend was lying there with us, was sunbathing. All of a sudden, without a word, Erling got up and started running down the beach. Now, that was something we had done together for years, would run and then come back and go in and body surf. But that day, he just got up without a word, started running. And something in me, you know, just said, you got to make up. And I don't think it's always my role to make up, and it's not always his, but that day I knew that we had to get it right. Kind of a premonition, I suppose. I don't know what it was, but it was that inner tape saying, you got to make up. So I got up, ran down the beach after him and yelled above the wind, do you want somebody to run with? And he turned around and he saw me and he reached out his hand, and I ran after him, and being younger than he is, I naturally caught up to him. And then we ran down the beach holding hands, and on the way back we walked back slowly, talking and breaking the silence and talking about how that night we'd go out for dinner together and we'd be alone. Well, I went back up on the beach blanket, and Erling said, I'll go down and serve for a minute and I'll be out. And of course he never came out, and we had to pull him out with a broken neck, totally paralyzed. But I guess that moment stays in our memory as being very important, that you learn to communicate. So we never let fights go anymore. If we get into one of those round robin things on dumb little things that don't matter, or on anything, we try now to talk them out. And we found this conversation, I don't know how many of you have read The Intimate Enemy by Bach, but it's a good book. And now here's the kind of arguments that we might get into if we change, and we're talking about people changing. Here's a woman who suddenly doesn't want to play bridge anymore. So here's a little, I think we're growing apart.
Come on.
I really think we are.
How do you mean?
Well, for instance, I'm getting damn tired of playing bridge all the time.
But you love bridge.
Not anymore, I don't. I've got better things to do. Well, you can see where that argument's going to go. But now suppose, here's another example of how a couple might deal with some serious changes that are taking place. And this ties us in with the story by Margaret Drabble about the day of the life of a smiling woman.
I don't care if you do all these things as long as it doesn't distract you from the main show, me, the house, and the kids.
What you call distraction means coming alive to me. I'm a better person now than I was when I devoted myself entirely to you and your glory, as I did last year and the year before. You were my whole world.
Was that so bad? I don't see what's so wrong with that. I loved it. And you gave me every indication that you loved it, or else I would have never married you. I need a woman who is 100% with me. I had the other kind before. I don't need that again. In fact, I won't have it, do you hear?
Oh, now, Joe, darling, stop that. Stop working yourself up into an unhappiness that's not really there. All that's happening to us is that I'm growing up a little.
By turning your back on your husband? You call that growing up? I call it regressing to selfishness.
What's really your beef? What do you want?
You know what I want.
You want me to be your darling slave and be happy to be fortunate enough to be the wife of the exciting, interesting, and brilliant professor, you.
Instead of enjoying my success and the benefits we both get from it, you're knocking it. Are you jealous or something?
I want you to be a success. I want you to enjoy it. But your success isn't enough for me.
Why not? Before I married you, and even up to last year, everything I did professionally was interesting to you. Well, while we're at it, you used to be more interested in sex, too.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with our sex life. We make love anytime we want to, don't we? And have I ever refused you?
Well, no, not directly. But indirectly, yes. I'd say you've lately refused
Well, how's that? What do you want from me?
Well, might as well give it to you straight. Most of the time our sex is boring now. I don't think your heart's in it.
Well, what else can I do? I'm there with you.
Well, you're there in body, but not in spirit. You let me have sex with you, but when you're not really with it, I feel like a fool. I wish you'd get with it the way you used to. I don't want to be tempted to get it elsewhere. I don't want, like, to run around and cheat on you.
Notice the threat. That's silly. I love making love to you. It's just that it has a different meaning to me now than it used to, that's all. don't make a federal case out of this. Sure, I used to be a frantic swinger to please you. I was so insecure I had to put on the big act because I felt that I had nothing else to offer, just sex. All I know is that I loved you, and I wanted you for my husband and father of my children, and I still do. But who can swing from the chandelier all the time? I admit my mind is on other things now.
Other men?
Oh, are you kidding? You're all I want. I'm satisfied.
Then what's so much on your mind that keeps you less interested in sex?
Well, I'll tell you. I'm concerned right now with my own identity. I'm tired of just being Mrs. Big Shot.
Oh, now I get it. It's that damn book you've been carrying around, where that frustrated housewife tells women how to live and get identity. Well, let me tell you, honey, the best identity you'll ever have is right here, right through me. Our home, our family, you and I, we, right here. That's your real identity. Out there is the jungle. Anyone that's telling girls like you that your identity is out there is really spinning a myth. I think that book has been very destructive for our marriage.
I don't think so at all. But if you do, you should take the responsibility. It's all your fault.
My fault? That's absurd.
Well, everywhere we go, you get all the action. You're the important person. I'm just a pretty tag-along, a nothing.
But don't I include you in everything?
Sure, as part of your audience.
Well, of course. You're my wife and part of my show. What's wrong with that?
Nothing. I like it. But it's not enough for my own identity. That's why I've started doing outside things around town without your help. And I'm beginning to make a place for myself in the world. Singing, painting, studying. And let me tell you, it feels great. Even though it's a tough struggle at times. That's what my mind is on these days. And I would love you even more if you could understand what I'm trying to do and trust me that it's for our mutual benefit. Well, I think you can see that this fight is a growth fight. And the kind of interaction that would help that couple get to know each other in ways they had never known each other before. And I think you note that one of the secrets was that she did not let herself get hooked by his innuendos and his threats and his put-downs, but she just kept pressing the point, just saying, look, I do love you, and not becoming defensive, but just stating her case and keeping on stating it until he finally listened. And I guess when we talk, you know, about two-part harmony, what we're trying to say is that as changes come in your life, as they do, whether it's, you know, when you're engaged, when you're married, if you're with a friend, whatever, the important thing, if you aren't to be alienated from each other by change, that you just have to keep communicating in this kind of non-defensive but assertive way. Because if she had backed down and gone back into the role that he had kept her locked into, what would have happened would have been an increase of hostility and anger until, like that woman that Erling mentioned, who, the pilot's wife, you know, when she'd had it, she had it. And if you read the accounts of Louis Neisser, for instance, one of the great lawyers who went through a lot of divorce cases with clients, he said that what he had found was that men could be negotiated with often when they were thinking about divorcing. But when a woman makes up her mind, she will wait longer, she will give the relationship more time and more investment. But when she's made up her mind, then she's usually through.
See.
So I think it's important to keep those channels of communication going in order not to have, as he says, a gunny sack full of complaints that eventually you dump or it explodes. I think we have time for questions now,
comments,
or comments.
Suggestions.
Debate. Anger, hostility.
anybody?
I have a question. I have parents that are similar to you two in background and in their marriage and situation. What role is best for the kids to play? Well, of course, now I'm out of the home, but sometimes we get used as middlemen in between their fights. And what's the best way to not become the dependent, but enable them to keep their communication lines open and not have them use us?
Yeah, my feeling is that you can't do much about it. You have to get an objective third party. Mm-hmm. And you could urge them to go to a counselor if it's really getting to be destructive to their relationship. But maybe the fights might seem more destructive to you than they really are.
I would suggest, too, that you stroke every moment that you see one of them is doing something neat. Polish the goodies. I just think you're beautiful, Dad, the way you treated her, or vice versa. Because it's often such an emotional thing. I mean, you feel, when I said a couple, 3 days ago, that this psychiatrist mentioned the cry of all of us that we manipulate into a million different forms is, does anyone give a damn if I'm here? Anyone love me? And if you're hurt or cut off at the bridge or have an illusion that you aren't wanted, the wall starts being built and then the bricks go up. And if you can help remove a few bricks, then the other person responds, you know, like one couple married a long time, and finally she was very thrilled because he began hanging his clothes up. Well, that was a victory of immense quality to her. That's fine, see? Then you polish that one and wait for others to have.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, as Mark says, a member of the family is very difficult. But you can sure polish the goodies. I think it's beautiful you're, you know, relating to her now, and vice versa, whatever.
It may just be, you know, we grew up as Christians often with the idea that all fighting is bad. Where fights, and I'll talk more about this Saturday morning when I talk about church fights.
We're having a
fights
three-ring service.
Congregations. That fighting is a way of shaping a relationship and establishing identity. You know, you say this is who we are by doing that, but it depends. If the round robin kind of fights over trivial things, then those are pretty destructive in the long run.
You fight with yourself. You do something, you paint, you speak. When you get through, you kick yourself four ways for doing it the way you did. You wish you'd done it differently. The sermon after is much better than the one you gave. So you fight yourself. You know? Always destructive, it's grief.
That's why it's so difficult. Sometimes you meet people that have been married for a long time and they say that you have had a
How tragedy. What a tragedy.
Yeah, it's possible. I would think if you were, you know, if you both came, if you were both open, honest, revealing people and could deal on a feeling level and were people who had been trained to listen to other people non-defensively, it's possible. Exactly. What was normal discussion to me, to Erling, was just a terrible.
I saw that in the Safeway once, two Jewish persons, couple, you know, they came to the celery. He said, I like the white. I want the green. I want the white. I want the green. I want the white. And every article they bought, and it was normal. Yeah. It was not nothing destructive.
Yeah, they were simply, you know, shaping their wants and letting the other person know.
A little more than normal.
Well, one of the mottos that Erling and I take for our marriage is the one from Ephesians 5:21. And often you hear the rest of the passage quoted and very little emphasis given to Ephesians 5:21. But we like that. It says, and the word there is the same as later on. It says, wives, be subject to your husbands. This says, be subject to one another. And the word is submissive. It says, be submissive to one another out of reverence for Christ. And that submissive means, you know, get under each other's burdens. Serve each other. Be submissive to each other's needs and wants out of reverence for Christ, so that there is not a hierarchical model there at all. But both the the theme for the rest of it is both be submissive one to the other. So it's mutual submission. And I know that's such a big thing in Southern California, the whole submission, dominant submission model. And people will say to me, because they see that I'm kind of have a lot of freedom, and Erling has a lot of freedom, where we come and go, and yet we love each other and our lives are very close and very involved. And they say, you know, are you a submissive wife? And I say, oh yes, 100%. I'm submissive to Erling, 100%. And then I add, you know, the stinger, and he's 100% submissive to me. And that just blows them out of orbit. So I think, but unless we have that kind of mentality, you know, then we're going to be just attacking one another instead of having the kind of constructive interactions, fights if you want to call them, that shape our relationship and say, I'm closer to you than anybody else because I can fight with you.
Yeah. Okay. So have a good fight. Bless you.